The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
This is the Takeaway Podcast for Tuesday, November 22nd. It's also my mom's birthday. Happy birthday, Mom.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick, filling in for John Hockenberry today, and we thank you for listening. We want to look beyond American politics for a moment at the top of the show to an absolute crisis in Syria. Civilians are being killed as the bombing has intensified in the besieged rebel-held district of eastern Aleppo. The Syrian Observatory for Human Rights says dozens of people were killed over the course of the last couple of days as Syrian government forces and allied fighters advanced further into the city. The Assad government's bombing campaign has also damaged hospital facilities. There are currently no working hospitals or clinics in eastern Aleppo. The World Health Organization estimates that more than 250,000 people are now without critical hospital care there as the war rages on. Dr. Rola Hallam is a British Syrian doctor and founder and CEO of Can Do. That's a not-for-profit startup that helps transform health and humanitarian responses in war-devastated communities.
So I literally just got off the phone to them. I mean, what is happening right now is this generation's Rwanda. Civilians are literally being targeted and killed, 200 killed just inside the last 4 days. And five of the hospitals inside Aleppo have been bombed and put out of function. And now 275,000 people do not have access to any healthcare whatsoever. He described it as a catastrophic situation. They've sent out a big SOS to all aid workers and humanitarians around the world to try and do everything we can to help.
So we should be clear, this appears to be an intentional strategy of the Assad government and its allies to target these hospitals and clinics.
Well, Physicians for Human Rights have been documenting the targeting of healthcare in over the last 5 years, and they've documented nearly 400 attacks on hospitals and healthcare facilities. They say that 97% of this is by the Syrian regime and now Russian forces. And then, of course, there are other targets by other rebels, ISIS, and other armed groups. And it would appear to be used as a weapon of war, a strategy to disrupt healthcare in order to empty these areas of the civilians.
So we're talking about the eastern part of the city of Aleppo, which is rebel-held territory where these clinics and hospitals are being destroyed systematically. What are people in that eastern sector doing now for medical care? What do they do?
Basically, there are some very small little kind of first aid clinics that are there. Otherwise, people are being treated in like medical teams, you know, homes in their basements, just complete patchwork of just trying to bandage what they can. But essentially, there are no facilities to carry out any major surgery, which, as you can imagine, when there is intense bombing happening, there are so many injured. And there is actually literally no facilities to treat those. We need an urgent humanitarian corridor in order to allow more equipment and more supplies in so that we can continue to try and save these lives.
And what is the state of medical materiel in Aleppo, and how many trained doctors and nurses are there even left?
Right. Okay. So there are approximately 30 trained doctors left in eastern Aleppo. And of course, there are nurses and aid workers alongside that. You know, like we doctors and healthcare workers, we're really useless without our tools. We can have the knowledge and the skills, but unless, you know, I'm an anesthetist or an anesthesiologist, so, you know, unless I have my equipment, I'm not going to be able to anesthetize you. And with eastern Aleppo being totally besieged at the moment, we're not even able to get supplies in. And that's not just for medical supplies. There's no food and water being allowed in. And the UN a few days ago said that there are 20 days left until Aleppo citizens will starve to death.
The Assad government rejected a few days ago the latest truce proposal for Aleppo. No aid is getting through, as you mentioned. So it seems to be that their strategy is to basically starve out eastern Aleppo and cause its surrender here.
Yeah. I mean, it's a medieval tactic and it's been used sadly in so many wars beforehand. And I think, you know, this is the time. It's not just eastern Aleppo. You're talking about 4.5 million Syrians who are in hard to reach areas where we cannot get them aid access. This is outrageous in this day and age. And I think this really falls upon the United Nations and the member states to say that this is unacceptable, what is happening. And it's time to intervene and stop this silent killing.
Have groups like yours gotten any affirmative responses from the UN or from the US government, the British government, any other institutions that are trying in their own ways to push back in Syria?
To be honest with you, I don't see that there is a serious political will to stop what is happening. I think there has just become so many vested interests with this becoming an international war on Syrian soils. I don't see that any governments are doing anything behind paying us Syrians lip service. I think that post the Trump and the Brexit dramas that both our countries have had, I think there are many people who really want to rally behind a positive action to do some good. And I would love to be encouraging people to say we can all still do something to stop this massacre. We need to be speaking to our politicians and policymakers to say, this is our Rwanda. This massacre cannot be continuing to happen. We need to stop the killing. We need immediate humanitarian corridors. We need to generate that will and pressure to do something, because this war will stop, right? Like every other war. But it just requires our kind of renewed efforts to really push for that to happen, and urgently.
However, it seems like given the current state on the ground and in eastern Aleppo, that the Assad government and its allies don't have much of an incentive to relent on their strategy here. I hate to say that it appears to be working.
I agree with you. Yeah, it's working beautifully, isn't it? You know, and that's just it's a disgrace for the international community. You know, the United Nations is meant to be our international body for peace and security. And I think this really requires a deep, hard look at the United Nations and how it works or doesn't, in order to say this should not be allowed to happen. We've said time and time again, never again. And here we are. You're right. I don't think there is an incentive. And that's why that renewed political will really needs to come.
Dr. Rola Hallam is a British Syrian doctor and founder and CEO of Can Do. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Today, I would like to provide the American people with an update on the White House transition and our policy plans for the first 100 days.
President-elect Donald Trump took to YouTube yesterday to release his first public update on his transition to the presidency. He referred to a bunch of policy areas where he plans to announce executive actions on day one of his tenure in the Oval Office, from trade, the TPP, and trade deals to ethics reform and down the list. But we want to take a look at one specific area now.
On energy, I will cancel job-killing restrictions on the production of American energy, including shale energy and clean coal, creating many millions of high-paying jobs. That's what we want. That's what we've been waiting for.
Joining me now to discuss Trump's energy plan is Stephanie Joyce. She's energy reporter for Inside Energy. Stephanie, welcome.
Thank you.
First of all, what is the current state of the energy, coal, and shale jobs that Donald Trump is talking about? And is there capacity for many millions of high-paying jobs that he could get back?
Yeah, so, you know, coal, oil, and natural gas are all in a slump right now, and they have been for a little while. That's mostly due to market forces. That's not because of job-killing restrictions, as Trump put it. The oil market has been flooded by oil from here in the United States, as well as from the Middle East. You know, natural gas has been at historic lows because of all of the cheap gas that's been unleashed by fracking. And, you know, coal, there's just been a downturn in demand for coal. It also competes with natural gas. So the more natural gas and the cheaper the natural gas, the less coal. So there is a downturn in the energy industry right now, no doubt. But the impact that Trump might be able to have on those sectors is limited.
Well, taking coal as an example, politicians and others from coal-producing states like West Virginia, Kentucky, decry the loss of employment in that sector. But it's really a 40 to 50 year, if not longer, decline in the coal industry, right? We're not talking about a decline that's from the last 5, 6, or 8 years.
Yeah, I mean, we've certainly seen a downturn in coal in recent years, but especially back east, the decline in coal has been going on for decades. You know, at its height, the coal industry employed about 250,000 people. Today, it employs about 50,000 people, and many of those are out west. You know, I'm here in Wyoming, which is the largest coal-producing state in the nation. We produce a lot of coal, but with very few jobs. A lot of coal is mined by very few miners.
So what is it that Donald Trump can really do, whether it's on day one or within the first year or two, to fulfill this promise of many millions of jobs? Is there anything he really can do, at least to expand employment in oil and coal and shale like he's promising?
I think that will be very difficult for him to do. He has promised to kill some of the energy-related regulations that the Obama administration has put into effect, including the Clean Power Plan, which is the Obama administration's signature climate change rule. That would curb emissions from existing coal and gas-fired power plants. And that plan has actually been held up in court right now, but it almost certainly would have resulted in more coal-fired power plants being shut down. It wasn't scheduled to go into effect until 2022, though, so it probably won't have much of a short-term impact. You know, he could scrap the moratorium on coal leasing that's been in place for the last few months on federal lands. He could quash some of the regulations that have been imposed on oil and gas drilling on federal lands in recent months, including a regulation just finalized a week ago about methane emissions from oil and gas wells on federal lands. But that's not likely to bring back the market for any of either coal or oil or gas. You know, those are really market driven, and the markets for those are down right now, and he can't have much of an impact on the markets.
Meanwhile, what does the market look like for renewable energy? There are twice as many solar workers in America as coal miners. Some of that industry is federally subsidized, so we do have to talk about the actual market. But are there jobs to be gotten by a President Trump if they wanted to steer more investment towards renewable solar, wind, and other things like that?
He could certainly steer more investment into renewables, as the Obama administration has done. He's given no sign that that's his plan. He's called renewables ugly. He frequently refers to wind turbines killing birds. But, you know, he certainly could continue to invest in that. And I think whether he does or not, we're likely to see continued growth in the renewable energy sector. In a lot of states, it is a major economic engine. States make their own policy in a lot of cases. When it comes to utilities and electricity generation, those decisions are not made at the federal level. And so the states that do have renewable portfolio standards and things like that are likely to continue to drive the market for renewable energy.
So a bottom line that I'm taking from what you're saying, Stephanie Joyce, is that a President Trump may succeed in repealing lots of regulations on the coal and oil industry, but that the benefits of that are likely to accrue possibly to the corporate bottom line and not to workers' jobs.
I think it is probably unlikely that he will bring back a significant number of coal jobs and oil and gas jobs simply through repealing regulations. Yes.
Stephanie Joyce, energy reporter for Inside Energy. Thanks so much.
You're welcome.
The 2016 election wasn't just a Republican victory for the White House or Congress. Starting next year, Republicans have complete control of a record 32 state legislatures. Democrats will control just 13, with five states splitting control of their houses. Republican control is close to the point where states could start to move to amend the Constitution if they did it right. And here's something else to consider. President-elect Donald Trump says he'd like to see more power devolved to the states on issues like health care and abortion. And that can mean a big policy shift as programs move from influence in Washington to more and more states controlled by Republicans. David Daley is the author of The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. It's a book about how Republicans made huge advances in the 2014 state elections. David, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me, Todd.
So let's review the numbers. I went through some of the numbers of Republican near hegemony in state legislatures. What numbers are most important to you?
The amazing thing after this election is that we are still a 50-50 divided country, but Republicans have pretty much all of the power. Republicans control 69 of 99 state legislative chambers, have a record number of governors, 25 trifectas, which is a state where they control the governor, the state house, and the state senate. And according to the Americans for Tax Reform, a conservative group led by Grover Norquist, some 80% of the country now lives under at least some form of Republican government.
So what gave rise to this GOP dominance at the state level? We see election after election where Democrats win popular votes nationally, including the election we just had. Democrats have more voters, it seems, but far less power, especially at the state level.
This is no accident. In 2010, Republicans plotted their way back to power after Barack Obama's big win and the big gains Democrats made in the Congress in 2008 with a plan called Red Map for Redistricting Majority Project. Republicans committed to using the gerrymander, the oldest political trick in the book, in a radical and inventive new way in 2010 and in 2011, and they remapped the country using very aggressive new computer technology and a cloud's worth of demographic details and census information and voting records to draw themselves impregnable lines on which they cannot lose. There is a whole conversation right now about how Democrats live in the cities and Republicans live every place else. That obscures what the Republicans did in 2010 and 2011 to intentionally dominate redistricting, to draw themselves impregnable majorities in states even where they have only a minority of the vote, and to essentially take over our government.
So one of the scenarios here is a possible process where if state legislatures can agree between each other, they can call a convention and start amending the Constitution with things they want.
There's the possibility right now, as Republicans control as many state House chambers and state Senate chambers as they do, of calling a national constitutional convention. You could see a move to reform the Electoral College within this many states under Republican control, and it would not be in the direction that people want to see it reformed after 6 of 7 popular votes go one way. It would be towards more cases of Maine and Nebraska, where congressional districts feed into control of the Electoral College as opposed to the popular vote in the states. But there's a lot of room for danger here.
Well, amending the Constitution is still very difficult. It seems to me the more immediate scenario is regular old laws and programs that come from Washington. As Republicans control Congress, they try to devolve more power back to the states, and more of those states are Republican, as you mentioned. Medicaid is one example. Republicans in Congress are going to move to block grant that program, giving the money to the states and letting the states do what they want. If more and more of these states are under Republican control, that has an enormous direct and immediate impact on people, millions of people, tens of millions, who receive that Medicaid health care, and that's just one program.
Republicans have dreamed of this kind of control over Congress and the states for a long time. The entire purpose of Red Map was to give themselves a chance at this kind of dominance, even in a 50-50 country. So they are going to move quickly. A block granting Medicaid is probably one of those things that is going to head back down to the states. And there are, 31 states, 11 of them right now under Republican control that accepted the extra money from the Supreme Court in order to accelerate the expansion of Medicaid. But I think we also have to keep in mind that a lot of these states where Republicans have complete control, it allows them to come up with laws like a transgender bathroom bill in North Carolina, or the emergency manager law in Flint, Michigan, or the anti-labor and collective bargaining rules that were passed in Wisconsin. What you see in these states are legislatures that are beyond the control of the ballot box, and these legislators feel empowered to go as far as they can and as far as they want on legislation, knowing that they are impervious to any consequences.
After the victory of Donald Trump in the presidential election, absolute Republican dominance of state legislatures across the country that Democrats are now just realizing have them very, very far behind in important policies, including Medicaid and many others. David Daley is the author of a book with a difficult title if you're in radio. It's called Rat The True Story Behind the Secret Plan to Steal America's Democracy. David Daley, thank you.
Thank you, Todd.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first 3 Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Prosecutors in South Korea announced on Sunday that they will investigate South Korean President Park Geun-hye as a suspect in a growing corruption scandal that's touched on nearly every aspect of the government there. It's already led to multiple resignations and indictments within the president's administration. Nearly a million protesters have taken to the streets in Seoul in past weeks to demand the resignation or the impeachment of President Park. She's the first woman to be president of South Korea, but it's a complicated web of scandal involving everything, it appears, from shamanism to bribery, and it's testing the strength of Korean democracy. Joining me from South Korea, Suki Kim. She's contributing editor for The New Republic. Suki, welcome.
Hi.
There are accusations of influence peddling here, extortion, even a figure close to the president who's the famous daughter of a cult leader. Can you explain?
It's really a mind-boggling scandal, which exposed the corruption of this South Korean, what appeared to be stable democracy. You know, I've been in Seoul for a few weeks and have now been at the protest for 3 weeks in a row. I mean, the next protest is coming up this weekend. It's projected to be 3 million people. And it's touched every single aspect of the society. This woman, the confidant, has wielded influence and has basically created shell companies and you know, took money using the influence. And we're talking every field, from sports to entertainment industry to banking to real estate, everything.
So we're talking about a woman, a confidant, you said. This is a woman named Choi Soon-shi, right? She's a friend of the president, and she's accused of doing what?
So this friend is really someone Park Geun-hye grew up with, knew for over four decades, and is a daughter of a man who's a bit of a cult leader. Not only that, the woman also looked through all the classified documents. So it seems not only all this money corruptions, but also the woman was involved in making decisions in, you know, president's affairs and national affairs. And this woman's not a classified person. Like, no one knew she was there all this time. So I think that this has shocked people. But, you know, it's not only this. It's just that there's been a brooding anger among people, which I guess through this occasion has erupted.
And specifically, Choi Soon-shi, the friend, is accused of setting up shell companies, basically charging for access to the president or to the presidential office, right? Is there any evidence now that Park herself, the president, was complicit in all this?
Yes, there are many evidences are coming up. Every day is a breaking news. It's really kind of at the emotional core of the anger, which goes back to the ferry disaster of 2014. If you remember, there was a Sewol ferry, South Korean ferry, that sank, and about 300 high school students died in it. And President Park was missing for 7 hours. And now evidences are coming up. Some of it hasn't still been verified, that she was possibly doing a cosmetic surgery with a hospital. And now that part has been proven, that there's a clinic, private clinic involved, which is where, of course, Choi Soon-shi has a lot of stakes in this clinic. And the doctor has won a lot of government funding and contracts and product placements. I mean, this is as insane as it sounds.
What has Park said in her own defense?
None to speak of.
So does it appear then that this scandal is headed for impeachment for President Park? Is there a way to really assess the overall quality of the charges? I mean, you've listed so many things.
So many things. An impeachment proceeding has actually begun. The opposition has declared it officially that they're pursuing it. Right now, they're coming up with the date early December. And the now courts are saying, you know, if half of the accusations prove to be true, because now it's a federal investigation, no longer as a witness, but as a suspect, then she could easily be impeached. Although it's a very complicated process, and she would end up being a first president to be impeached. I mean, it's a shame on so many levels, this first female president also becoming the first impeached president in the Korean history.
A rapidly expanding scandal, a million people perhaps in the streets of Seoul demanding the resignation or impeachment of South Korean President Park Geun-hye. Suki Kim in Seoul, contributing editor for The New Republic. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Welcome back. Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry today. Life is stark for many of the people of the Ojibwe tribe in the small village of Pine Point in northern Minnesota. Many are trapped in cycles of trauma and neglect. Violent drug culture and gang life are rampant. There appears to be few ways to make it out in search of a better life. A new documentary film takes an intimate, honest, and difficult look at life in Pine Point. It's called The Seventh Fire, and in it, Native American filmmaker Chris Iyer teams up with director Jack Riccobono to go inside the lives of addicts and gangsters and their families in Pine Point. They spent 3 years on the White Earth Reservation following a man called Rob Brown. He's a larger-than-life gang leader struggling with addiction and with his own choices as he heads to prison for the fifth time. In the film, we also meet Kevin. He's a smart and charismatic 17-year-old kid about to make a choice between getting out or pursuing his dream of becoming the most powerful drug dealer on the reservation. Riccobono says that to the outside world, Rob might get branded as an ex-con, but he's a complex individual.
He's very creative. He's a self-taught writer who got into creative writing when he was imprisoned. It was really, you know, meeting Rob that really began the journey of telling this story and looking at the influence of gang culture on remote Native communities, which was something that, you know, we had set out to examine. But it was really through Rob's story, I think, that we were able to kind of see the complicated nature of that.
You're with them when they're doing drugs and selling drugs, illegal activity, in the room with Rob while he's talking to his lawyer. That's privileged. The camera's there the whole time, and it made me just wonder how that access developed. Where did that come from?
Well, you know, Rob was really a collaborator in the making of the film, and I think that he really understood what we were trying to do with the film, and he was able to bring us in places that we wouldn't have been able to go on our own. So, you know, there was that, and we also gave cameras to Rob and Kevin, our younger subject, so that they could shoot certain things, you know, that we wouldn't be able to shoot on our own, and that they would have the experience of also being behind the camera.
Chris Iyer, you've been involved in a lot of other projects involving Native Americans, Native American culture. You directed 3 episodes of American Experience on PBS, which is something that a lot of people will have seen, and this is a much sort of darker, closer, more difficult look at Native American life. And I wonder why you got involved here and what you wanted to bring out.
Well, I got involved when Jack reached out to me with an early sample of the footage. And the thing that struck me was Rob Brown, like Jack just said, and the access that they had. You know, as a Native person, I keep a pulse on what's going on. But to see what Jack was able to show with his camera and the access that Rob was able to give really enlightened me towards what's going on. And from there, you know, I lived in the Northern Plains in South Dakota and understand some of the issues going on with the North Dakota pipeline and incarceration. And I thought, you know, as difficult as it is to sometimes see and process, you know, politically and socially, it doesn't mean that it shouldn't exist for people to understand.
So, Jack, there's a moment in this film where Kevin, who's about 17, he's a younger guy, kind of under Rob's wing, kind of doing some low-level drug dealing, hanging out with his friends. He says,
I still have the idea of being a big drug dealer. Like, it's still in my mind today. I still want to be one, yeah, but also want to get a job and try to do somewhat the right way so I could get started on something.
And you can see him just standing at this choice point right in the middle of the film.
Absolutely. And that's, you know, part of what drew us to Kevin. You know, we met him about a year into filming when he literally just walked into frame one day. And through Kevin's eyes, you know, you see Rob in a whole different way because you see how Rob is this larger than life figure who's having this major impact on Kevin. And Kevin, as a 17-year-old, is at a very different point in this cycle. You know, he's never been to state prison. He's been in juvenile detention, but he's at this major crossroads in his life where he can choose, you still choose, you know, sort of which way to go. Because, you know, once you have that criminal conviction, it becomes very difficult to get employment, and you also get pulled into the gang culture within the prison system. And I think, you know, seeing their two stories together allows you to enter into these issues in a different kind of way.
Chris Iyer, we've talked about sort of the closeness and a lot of the difficulty, sort of the abjectness that's in this film. But then the film is over. I have to say, not a lot of it is uplifting. There's no gratuitous hope, which is kind of nice. But what do you want the result of this film to be in the world?
Well, I think the result of this film is that there's a resiliency in Rob. There's an optimism in Rob's writing. There's a pathway for him to get out of his situation.
I was a very bad example. I was a part of what's going on out there. I want this cycle to end.
And I think that that's really what the hope is for me, which is that people see this movie and they look at themselves, Native people, also, and say, okay, there's a way to improve your situation. I mean, Rob was in 39 foster care homes, and I have no idea what that does, you know, to somebody. I was part of the adoption system in my early years, so I empathize with Rob deeply. There's statistics that say that Native people are disproportionately incarcerated to longer sentences in states near and on reservations. And so, you know, we have to look at this problem and say, okay, there's something happening here. And the front line is not where the war is always waged. It's sometimes in the judicial system, and Rob was and has been a part of that.
So Rob has come out, clearly. He had a 57-month stretch, as you said, in your film. Where's Kevin now? How's he doing? What's he up to?
Kevin is, you know, still kind of at a crossroads. He did get a job and was working full-time at a fast food restaurant for several months. And during that period was when he sort of reached out and came with us to the White House. And that was his first time on an airplane and the first time out of the state of Minnesota. And so I think that had a big impact on him. And he was able to meet the Native activist, Albino Garcia, who appears at the end of the film trying to reach Kevin and bring him to this institute in New Mexico that tries to reconnect troubled Native youth with their culture. And so that's still an open invitation for Kevin to go down there and pursue that, you know, if and when he's ready to take that step.
The positive outcome of this film is that Rob and Kevin have both found their voices in part, if that's what we do. I've seen Rob travel around the country and inspire people just with his story. And I think that he's really found his voice through this film. And it's a pleasure to see.
Chris Iyer is executive producer of the new documentary, The Seventh Fire. It's streaming now on iTunes and Amazon. Jack Riccobono is director of The Seventh Fire. It's a film very much worth watching. Thank you both for joining me.
Thanks, Todd.
Thanks for having us.
To North Carolina now, where the election is not over. The governor's race between Republican Governor Pat McCrory and Democratic challenger Roy Cooper is not yet settled. Cooper currently leads that count by approximately 6,600 votes, although Cooper's campaign team has calculated a higher cap of about 8,000. The McCrory campaign has protested results in several counties, and today the State Board of Elections convenes to provide legal guidance on how to respond to complaints. For more, I'm joined by Capitol Bureau Chief for North Carolina Public Radio, Jeff Tiberi. Hi, Jeff. Welcome back to the show.
Hello, Todd. Good to be here.
We're used to seeing expectation-setting claims of irregularities in close elections. That's common. Is this different?
It does feel a little bit different. It feels like there's somewhat of a trickle-down from the national rhetoric. Now, as some brief context, these two are separated by what you mentioned are just a few thousand votes. This is less than 0.2% of all the votes that were cast. That was about 4.7 million votes here in North Carolina. So a very, very narrow difference between these two. But in terms of these complaints and what we've seen in the 2 weeks now since the election, the governor's camp has alleged widespread fraud. And they're talking about people who have passed away, who have somehow voted, and felons who have voted, and folks who have voted twice in different precincts or in different counties. But what they haven't turned over yet at this point, and it remains to be seen if there is any, is concrete evidence, you know, indication that this really is widespread and that there are thousands and thousands of votes that shouldn't be counted or that need to be looked at. In short order, there's not a lot of evidence, at least that we've seen at this point, and there aren't enough votes that have been questioned thus far that even if they were all to side with the Republican incumbent, Pat McCrory, there aren't enough votes in question to sway this election at this point.
And throughout the process so far, state authorities have already seen and rejected several of McCrory's claims of fraud.
They have. Governor Pat McCrory's spokesperson, Ricky Diaz, I've chatted with him several times. But last week on Thursday, he said that they were filing complaints in 52 different counties. And when I pressed him for a number, I said, does that mean that there are 52 illegitimate votes or 500 or 50,000? What's the total number? Because The aggregate, of course, is very important, as we're talking about a race that's separated by 6,000. And they have not provided that number. They haven't actually, to the last check of my knowledge, they haven't filed complaints in all of those counties. Some of those are still coming. And yes, I mean, this is very narrow, but this is something that we haven't seen evidence on to this point.
So we have to talk about some of the unique laws in North Carolina, Jeff Tiberi, because North Carolina has a law, as I understand it, that lets the legislature declare the governor if the result is in doubt. And it appears to a lot of observers here that the strategy that Pat McCrory is using is trying to sow enough of that doubt to get this to a GOP legislature that can throw the election to him with their votes.
Right. There are supermajority Republicans in both chambers of the North Carolina General Assembly, in the Senate and in the House. Thus far, leadership has kind of deflected. The House Speaker, Tim Moore, has said that is an absolute last resort. At this point, it's certainly a gray area, and it's certainly something that some folks are concerned about. A lot of lawmakers have pointed to the media and said, hey, this is a media construction at this point. This is not something that is legitimate. It has only been used once before, and that was not for a governor's race, but it was for a race of the Department of Public Instruction and Education role 12 years ago. And in that instance, there was a Democrat who was leading in the vote totals, and it went to a Democratic legislature, and they upheld her lead, if you will. From my vantage point, it sets obviously a very dangerous precedent if, Roy Cooper is ahead by several thousand votes and it goes to the legislature and the result were to turn. Now, I think what could, and I still think it's a long shot, but what could bring this before the legislature is if there is more of a legitimate complaint or more concrete evidence that comes forward, or the governor says, I'm challenging 40 or 50,000 votes based on X. That hasn't happened at this point, but in theory, as you note, it certainly could. And although the statute says that if the legislature is the final judge in this, or if it goes to the legislature, that's the final say and it can't be challenged in court. That's the way the statute is written. However, if it were to go to the legislature, I would expect immediate challenges from a number of groups in both state and federal court.
And finally, before we go, I mean, all of the indications of the strategy that McCrory is using so far, because his claims have been rejected, as he's trying to get allied Republicans possibly in the legislature to share some of the political risk here of keeping his governorship going.
Correct. And even with these supermajorities, Governor McCrory doesn't have a lot of close friends in leadership within the General Assembly. And it doesn't appear at this point that he has a strong or widespread backing from those Republicans. It'll also be interesting to see what those Republicans do down the road with this almost foundation that's being laid of perceived fraud, if they're going to make another run at mandating voter ID or changing election law here, which has been a very controversial and contentious topic over the last several years.
A close governor's race in North Carolina, charges of voter fraud and countercharges that the Republican governor is trying to steal an election that he lost. Jeff Tiberi, Capitol Bureau Chief for North Carolina Public Radio. Thanks a lot.
Todd, my pleasure.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Eight protesters calling themselves White Lives Matter were arrested in Austin, Texas over the weekend. The demonstrations began Saturday morning during the unveiling of a monument at the Texas State Capitol dedicated to the contributions of African Americans to the state throughout history. The White Lives Matter protesters are, of course, a direct response to the Black Lives Matter movement, which has swelled in support since it began after the death of Trayvon Martin in 2012. And White Lives Matter also appear to have taken a strong cue from President-elect Donald Trump. Here he is at a campaign rally in Virginia back in February.
You can hear it once. All lives matter. All lives matter.
So now, with the election over, Black Lives Matter is at a crossroads for its movement. It was an election that went to a candidate who, as you just heard, stoked sentiments among white voters that were antithetical to the Black Lives Matter mission. It's a setback for the movement as it faces possible new policies on immigration and policing that cut against the achievements and conversations the group has fostered over the last couple of years. Opal Tometi is one of three co-founders of the Black Lives Matter movement. She's also currently running the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. And she says after the setbacks of the election, this has been a pivotal moment of looking inward.
We've been thinking a lot about the work that we have to do in our own communities, the work that we have to do with low-income Black and brown people who are, you know, struggling right now and really looking to defend themselves and ensure that they are safe in their communities and that their rights are maintained and forwarded. But we're also taking account the real disconnect that we feel is happening in our society with our political options and the two-party system, and really asking ourselves whether or not it truly serves us. For example, we're having a real discussion about Hillary Clinton, right? And making a distinction between the type of feminism that she represents, which is a particular type, and distinguishing between that and her actual track record, right? We're taking account for the real substantive actions that people that we elect into office or people who we hope to represent us at the highest office really stand for. And what we are now faced with is the fact that we didn't really have what it took or what it takes to elect the type of courageous, visionary leader that these times really warranted.
So it sounds like what you're reckoning with, if I'm reading what you're saying, is you're reckoning with a couple of things maybe in your coalition. One, Black folks did not come out to vote in the way that Democrats needed. And two, maybe this wasn't the right candidate for the Democratic Party and your movement should have done more to get behind somebody else like Bernie Sanders or some other type of candidate. I'm not sure if I'm reading that right.
No, actually, I wouldn't say that. I would actually say that there are a number of communities that weren't actually represented and didn't come out to vote. People were disillusioned by the candidates all across the board. And so we had, you know, people who actually just did not show up. And so I would never blame that on any community of color by any means. I think there, when we look at the statistics, we see that there was an overwhelming number of white women and even college educated white women who voted for a Donald Trump. And so I think that there has to be a little bit more nuance when we discuss who actually turned up, why did they vote in very various ways. And what I think our movement is actually grappling with is the fact that we have a disconnect between what is offered for us, right? So the representation that we see and what our experiences are on the ground.
You're in activist circles. You're extremely politically active, and most of the people around you are, surely. I know that you voted. Do you have people in your own life who even know you, friends, family, who didn't vote in this election either through apathy or disillusionment?
Yes, I do know some people who did not vote based on their sheer disillusionment with the candidates and what they felt that their vote could actually do.
What are those conversations like between you and somebody like that? Whether or not you tell them who to vote for, I don't know, but your entire life is politics at this point, and I think you have a pretty close connection to the idea that it matters.
These days, those conversations to me look like empowerment, ensuring that people, no matter what their political affiliation is, no matter what they're seeing in the candidates, that they feel connected to their own agency. And so they don't actually have to go out and vote.
I completely understand that with one part of my brain. And on the other part of my brain, when I talk to somebody like you, look, we all have a stake. But to hear somebody like you say it doesn't have to be about voting in an election that is razor thin close with unbelievable differences in consequences according to one candidate or the other, I sort of can't believe what I'm hearing.
And I could understand your astonishment. I absolutely can. I, however, honestly believe that. I encourage people to vote. I encourage people to engage in any act of democracy that they could possibly engage in. And for those who are disillusioned, and I, you know, we struggle, we go back and forth, and we lay out the spectrum of ways that people can get involved in their own, in their democracy. Some people don't see that voting is it, and I do not necessarily blame them.
So gains and goals, the actual goals of your movement. There have been some gains made since Black Lives Matter came on the scene in response to police violence. Body cameras is one small advance that have spread to some jurisdictions throughout the country. So what changes do you realistically want to see within the next 4 years? What's on your agenda in terms of policy, something specific that you want to see?
I'm really looking to work at the local level. I think we have a lot more opportunity and we have a lot more power there. We know that there are elected officials who have been working closely alongside our communities, our organizations for several years, and we hope to ensure that we can build out protective measures for the most vulnerable amongst us. So Muslim communities, immigrant communities, we need to ensure that we protect Black and brown youth first and foremost. And so we're looking for local solutions that begin to examine how funding is used. Is it being used to support education and housing and access to jobs and things like that? Or is it being used to over-police our communities? We're grappling with that at the very local level, and I think that there's a lot that our communities can do.
We've been asking a lot of people lately who've come on the show this question. I'm going to ask you, is Donald Trump your president?
I feel that he is a presence that is really the epitome of the backlash that our communities are experiencing, right? Just like countless other presidents that have come before him, we'll see amazing and vibrant social movements that aim to challenge the presidents and to transform our systems so that we have a society where there is equity and where there's justice for all of us.
Could you see yourself negotiating with, legitimizing Donald Trump in the Oval Office if you were invited?
What I'm most concerned about now is Black people. I'm also concerned about brown people, poor people. I'm in deep conversation with them at this moment about their survival and about how eventually we'll need to be back to thriving, right? Those conversations with somebody like a Donald Trump, I'm not sure that they need to be prioritized at this moment. And I think we have to be cautious about what it looks like to engage with people who have no stake in our humanity. And we have to continue to contest and build power amongst our own people so that we don't have to negotiate with hate.
Opal Tometi is co-founder of the Black Lives Matter movement. She's currently running the Black Alliance for Just Immigration. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's our show. We're going to let you go. I thank you so much for listening. You can always reach us 8778-MY-TAKE. I am Todd Zwillick. This is The Takeaway.